appreciate the tender kindness that all my predecessors on this platform have shown in preparing you for my address. They have all appealed to you to listen if it kills you. The Israelites were not comfortable in the exile, and Michelson is not comfortable following Gil. I mean, what does a feather duster do around a buzzsaw? For a man who's mad at Yak Yak, I think I've witnessed a man who's in heat for Yak Yak. Well, I have to talk to you about the rebellion of man, and my heart isn't in it because I don't feel very rebellious at the moment. But you all know about the 19th century Danish philosopher Soren Kierkegaard. When he was a young man, he thought that he'd like a job being a policeman. He thought that the clever, crafty wit of the criminal would be a very apt foil for his own wit, until he discovered that the work of the policeman was almost entirely taken up with the petty cares of the people. So then he decided he might become a preacher, until he made the discovery that the work of the preacher was almost entirely taken up with the petty cares of the people. And this, as he said, he found too loose a ground on which to place the lifting jack of religion. Now, this was the 19th century, and the cares of the people may have been petty in the 19th century, but you can scarcely say that of their cares today. In our time, for instance, the world has shrunk so small that whole groups of people rub together in the friction we call social injustice. And when that friction becomes acute, society breaks out in crime and open war. In our time, the tempo of life has become so sped up that in our effort to keep up with it, we develop the interior friction called anxiety, the fatigue of the psyche. And when that fatigue becomes acute, we break down in neurosis and sometimes even psychosis. You see, man was made to live in a garden, but nowadays we're forced to live in a metropolis. Some people attempt to escape the crowded and sped up conditions of the metropolis and move out into suburban and sub-suburban areas where life is not so fast and tight. People from Indianapolis and Chicago move out to this little hamlet, West Lafayette, and think thereby to escape their problems. But they discover that the very same problems that cropped up under metropolitan conditions continue to crop up under these more rural conditions, which leads them to suspect what the psychologist Alfred Adler has said, that there is a marathon runner in the soul. One brings his problems with him because they are in him. For instance, you're driving along a highway one day and you're really not going anywhere in particular, but a car begins to creep up alongside you to pass you, and your foot automatically goes down on the accelerator. Why? You will not be passed. Man is a being who, if he is coming in second, feels as if he is coming in last. You look at a list of names alphabetically arranged. You wish your name were Anderson rather than Zepp. You look at a list of names arranged in the order of seniority, and you'd die to be first. Indeed, you'd almost have to. You carry this penchant for being first in your very being until at last even God, the number one citizen of the universe, poses as your rival, and you can't stand him. And when that happens, injustice and neurosis are shot through with the fundamental rebellion of man, which is unbelief. Mind you, when we say unbelief, we don't say simply, you can't accept certain ideas about a God. Unbelief is a condition of existence where a man braces himself against a reality that supersedes him, named God. These are the fundamental rebellions of our time. They aren't all the rebellions, but they're the only ones I'll be able to deal with. Injustice, the rebellion of a man against his fellow man. Neurosis, the rebellion of a man against himself. And unbelief, the revolt of man against God. I'd like to deal with these, each of them briefly and in order, and then try to point out how they relate to one another. First of all, injustice. I suppose the person in America who helped us best in the church to understand this concept was the Baptist church historian, Walter Rauschenbusch, the father of the social gospel. When Rauschenbusch was a young boy, he used to spend part of his summer up in New York State with his grandparents in a very pious Mennonite community, where they had a practice that if a farmer were to bring polluted milk to the creamery, he'd be penalized by having red labels placed on his milk cans, his empty milk cans, silent accusers on the road home, like Nathaniel Hawthorne's red letter, A, adulterer. Rauschenbusch saw this happen to a farmer one day, and he heard the farmer respond with an oath. The next Sunday, the farmer was brought up before his local congregation for trial, for possible excommunication. The question is, what was the charge against him? For, as Rauschenbusch says, introducing cow dung into the intestines of innocent little babies? No. But rather for referring to the damnation of the wicked in an untheological way. This curious disproportion between petty sins of impiety and gross social abuses struck the conscience of Rauschenbusch even as a small boy. Later on, he was a preacher in New York City, and he used to spend some time every Saturday afternoon reading the newspapers, determining what youth groups and ministers were discussing and talking about on Sunday. And these, he discovered, were the prevailing themes: dancing, card playing, theater going, smoking, drinking. These were the prevailing sins in the capital city of an economic system that was at that time breaking the back of an entire class of people. And Rauschenbusch sensed the gross disproportion between petty sins of impiety and social abuses, and he screamed out against social injustice as an authorized concept of rebellion against God, which the church has labeled sin. Who helped him understand this? Well, the 8th century prophets and the teachings of Jesus. But who helped him rediscover these prophetic teachings? It was Karl Marx. It was Karl Marx who talked about the estrangement of man from man, the rebellion of man against his fellow man. It was Karl Marx who talked about how fewer and fewer people are getting richer and richer, more and more people are getting poorer and poorer, and you can stretch this rubber band of society only so far before it will snap in social revolution. The revolution didn't come about in our country. Thanks to the benevolent administration of the Democratic Party for 25 years, the revolution didn't come about. This does not mean Marx was not a prophet. And I advise you that I have an early plane connection. A prophet is not one who simply predicts, he is one who forewarns, and you have time to rectify the conditions that might otherwise bring about social calamity. As a matter of fact, the Marxian warning still holds with a Damoclean threat over our heads at this very moment. According to Marx, society was meant to be a community, hence communism. But what have we made of it? We have made of it a marketplace. I wasn't married for a year before my wife insisted on having a brand new automatic wash machine. Up to that time, love had been enough. Whole units of society, like the family, were meant to be based upon a love nexus. But, in the term of William James, we have built these units upon a cash nexus. But the Marxian warning is a double-edged warning. For he has said to us that the bourgeois man has made even of his wife a mere instrument of production. You know, recently I went down into the subway system of New York City. I live within 24 miles. Drew University is within 24 miles of New York City. Up to this moment, 60 trains a day into the city, a kind of a commuter's village. We don't get in too often, those of us who teach in Madison, but occasionally I go in, just enough to get jostled in the subways. I haven't learned not to go into them at 4:30 in the afternoon when everybody else in New York City is there. And I was in there one day and trying to negotiate my way into a subway car when, a woman shot by me and jabbed me with her elbow and got into the car ahead of me and the doors closed and I was left standing there. I mean, it hurt. I could show you, I think, still a bruise on my side from her elbow. But do you know, I don't blame that woman. I blame the New York City subway system. That is to say, with a little social intelligence, collisions like this could be eradicated. See, why does everybody in New York City have to be in this subway system at the same time? Why not stagger office hours so that people could be dismissed a few at a time? Or why not widen the doors of the subway? You go into a restaurant in this town and you'll discover that the cooks continually argue with the waitresses. And sometimes it gets very nasty and heated. And it's hard to digest your food under those conditions. That ought not prevail. You get some social engineer to go in there, he'll size the situation up like that. He'll build a solid wall between the kitchen and the dining room. So waitresses never have to come in contact with cooks. That's great. There are socially intelligent ways of solving social friction. Gunnar Myrdal, the famous Swedish sociologist, has said there is such a thing as social self-healing. Injustices can be overcome by social intelligence, and we need to apply more of it. But about that woman, do you know, she jabbed me with a force all out of proportion to the requirement for getting her into that subway? Which leads me to conclude that not the whole problem was in that situation. Some of the problem was in that woman. And this is what another one of the great prophets of our time has helped us see, Sigmund Freud. Beneath all injustice, there is some neurosis. Beneath all revolt of man against his fellow man, there is some interior revolt within the human spirit. A father comes home from a busy, harried day at the office. His little boy meets him at the door. He sweeps the little kid aside and strides into the dining room and demands his supper. Why does he do this? He hates little boys? No. Odd as it may seem, he hates himself. And the only way he has to cope with himself is to project himself into the little boy and strike at himself there. A political demagogue attempts to eradicate an entire race of people. Why? He hates Jews? No, strange as it may seem, he hates himself. And the only way he has to get at himself is to project himself into that race and strike at himself there. As Sigmund Freud has pointed out, the human personality, you know, is after the pattern of an iceberg, just a little peak of consciousness above the surface, and all the rest of us a great subconscious self beneath the surface. And this conscious self has one law by which it operates. The subconscious self has another law by which it operates. Under certain circumstances and in certain people, these two laws come into conflict. There is, as the Apostle Paul has said, there are two laws warring in our members. There is a kind of a civil war within us, or if you prefer, a kind of a war between the states of our consciousness. And when we are called upon to do some high, noble thing that requires the mobilization of our personality, this civil war within us so fatigues us interiorly that we can't pull ourselves together to do this whole thing. Well, people accused Freud of generalizing on human nature from the few instances of human nature he saw in his doctor's office. Despite that rumor, Freud wrote a little book that you can get on any newsstand for 35 cents now called The Psychopathology of Everyday Life, in which he said there is none good, no, not one. That is to say, there are in each of us the ingredients for the development of neurotic symptoms. And he showed from common, ordinary, everyday things that all of us do, how the cleavage, the dichotomy, the brokenness, the rebelliousness within the human spirit is manifested innocently. For instance, loss of memory. I had my wife in New York City shortly after we were married, and we ran across one of my old girlfriends from the Middle West. I had to introduce my wife. I couldn't remember the girl's name. I knew it better than I knew my wife's. Why couldn't I remember? You say, I was embarrassed. Well, what's the meaning of embarrassment? Why do people get embarrassed? You say, I was fatigued. What's fatigue? Actually, would you have expected me in one conscious moment to remember what for 2 years I had been subconsciously trying to forget? There are two laws warring in our members, so that when we try to pull ourselves together for some form of efficient action, we're helpless, we're crippled, victims of our own interior states. Or you take an innocent little thing like slips of the tongue. I had my mother-in-law over one night, and in an honest effort to be conciliatory, I said to her, Marianne, isn't it a shame we don't live closer apart? What did I mean? What did I mean? I meant both things, my conscious mind and my subconscious mind. And in this moment, I was not even master in my own house. This is not a domestic judgment. This is what Freud called a psychological judgment. I was the victim rather than the master of my own states. Now, sometimes this comes off very beautifully. As, for instance, in the plays of Shakespeare, you take The Merchant of Venice, where Ophelia is in the presence of the casks from which Bassanio will choose, and if he chooses the right one, she will be his bride. And she wants to communicate to him that it matters to her that he choose the right cask. So she says to him, one half of me is yours, and the other half yours, or mine, I mean, but if mine, then yours, so I am all yours. That's beautiful. But it only illustrates what Freud and Paul the Apostle were pointing out, that it is possible that there are two laws warring in our members so that we are not even master in our own house. I don't want to be alarming to this group, but do you know this very important lesson for you within the next 5 years, because according to psychologists, within the next 5 years, you will live through all three of the situations in life that are most likely to produce breakdown. For instance, formal education. It demands of us the acutest concentration, our whole concentration of energy upon our studies. But what if we're not whole? Formal education will simply illustrate or elicit our brokenness. Vocation, the choice of a vocation. When a man chooses a vocation, he chooses to throw his whole life into one job. But what if he's not whole? The demands of vocational life just illustrate and produce brokenness. Marriage. In marriage, a person gives his whole life to one other person. But what if he's not whole? The requirements of marriage simply produce our interior brokenness. That's why it would be so important if listening to these secular prophets, I agree with Ted Gill, if listening to these secular prophets open up some of the diseases and problems of our time, we could adduce some answer that they have not got from within themselves. Or if, even apart from that, if listening to these secular prophets, we could feel that we from within the faith have something to contribute to the poignant problems of the present day man. This is where it is important to understand that beneath all injustice there is some neurosis, and beneath all neurosis there is some unbelief. Dostoevsky said it this way: you do not believe in God or Christ, therefore you are so eaten up with pride that chances are you will end by devouring one another. Get that chain reaction? Jesus said it: thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and thy neighbor as thyself. Is the Christian illumination of existence to say that if a man falls away from God in unbelief, he will fall apart inside in neurosis, and chances are he will end by falling against his fellow man in injustice? I'd like to explain this a little through the use of a little formula, the mechanisms of unbelief. There is at the root of our lives an anxiety to secure our existence. Let me take three words from that formula. Root. This is what we deal with in the church. The root of existence. I once saw a dancer who could lean her forearms like this on a table and so artfully arch her spine that she could bring her feet down before her eyes. And as I watched her, I got the impression she thought she was contemplating herself in her pedal extremities. At that moment, she became a kind of a symbol of our culture. We see ourselves in our achievements, technological and otherwise, but do we see the root of our existence that joins us to the ultimate being we call God? A man is not fully a man until he is rooted in God. This is what it means to be a man, to be in the image of God, that is to say, to assume responsibility for obeying the number one reality. A man is not fully a man who does not do that. There is at the root of our lives an anxiety to secure our existence. This is what we are, an existence, ex istere, to stand from. Man is a being who stands from some other being than himself. Animals don't exist. They're too opaque in their instincts to stand from anything else. God does not exist. There's nothing beyond him to inspire his reach. Man alone exists. God minus man equals God. That's the simple arithmetic of theology. Man minus God equals nothing. As the Indian proverb has it, we are but skin about a wind. Let God withdraw his creative breath and we will be what we would be without him. Nothing. Now, man will not be nothing. He will be something, even if he has to pump himself up. He will be something in his own right. This business about being a gardener didn't please Adam. It doesn't please us. We want to be manufacturers. This business about being a steward in God's garden doesn't please us any more than it did Adam. We want to be proprietors. So, We're like a dancer who leaps very high into the air. While he's up there, he gets the illusion he's not a man, he's something higher than a man. He wants to perpetuate that illusion. We're like a conductor in the presence of a symphony. As he's waving his arms wildly, he gets the impression he's not just directing the music, he's creating it. We leap very high in our imagination until we penetrate an atmosphere that is uncongenial to our lungs because it's made for God, not man. While there, our head dizzies and we spin and we fall and we throw out our arms to break our fall, and in that moment, we crush others beneath us. A man who falls away from God in unbelief falls apart inside and will end by falling against his fellow man. Two merchants on the same street corner. How does it happen they don't seem to be able to survive on any other basis except economic murder? Two brothers in the same family. You get a letter from your brother: I've just been made captain of the football team. Then you sit down and you write a letter of congratulations, and you mean it. But how do you forget that instant? Two nations in the same world, two colors in the same country. My friends, there is a law and a gospel in life. There is a law that says life cannot be well lived on the basis of self-sufficiency. And there is a gospel that says God is constantly reaching in his hand to reconcile us to himself. And wherever that hand intersects our life, a cross is formed. Maybe you think I've been unduly pessimistic. I prefer to appeal to the lines of the British Catholic poet Francis Thompson. Is not this gloom shade of God's hand outstretched caressingly? How do you reconcile a man who is alienated? How do you overcome rebellion? How do you get a man who is in a bad humor to be in a good humor? Well, you say, cheer up. You do not. You drive him to drink. That's not the answer to his problem. That's his problem. Well, then maybe you'll tell him a joke. Yeah, but if he doesn't have a good humor, he won't get it. Well, then maybe you will tell him you have told him a joke. Well, then he may laugh to please you, but there'll be no collateral twinkle in his eye. What if a young couple comes to the minister and says, we're no longer in love? And he says to them, but you ought to love each other. It's ridiculous. That's their problem, not the answer. How are you going to cure insomnia? Get plenty of sleep. Two men are on a tightrope, and they fall. I mean, in a great circus performance, high up in the tent, very high for purposes of this story, because on the way down, they do some interesting things. One man says to the other, I'm a little chilly. The man says, well, here, take my coat. And the other man says, you know, I feel hungry. Well, I just happen to have a sandwich in my pocket. I suppose if you ask them what they were doing, they'd say, we're building the kingdom. But they're going to their doom. Man on the radio asks, what are you going to do about falling hair? Answer, step aside. This little girl next door loans me her father's bushel basket to pick up some grass on my lawn. And when I'm through, I say, here, Francine, take it back. She says, I don't want to. And I try to trick her. I say, it's nothing. Just step inside the basket, hang on to both handles, pick yourself up, and carry this thing home. Just like that, she saw through it, and she wouldn't do it. People don't see through that. Adults, older people, they don't see through that. They're continually attempting to solve the problems of their existence from within the problems. like Archibald MacLeish in J.B. When life falls in around him, what does he say? Blow on the coal of the heart. The candles in churches are out. The lights have gone out in the sky. Blow on the coal of the heart, and we'll see by and by. That's not bad. It's better than most pious, woolly, mama bear, Reader's Digest optimism that dominates the white nighty Sunday school class. But it is not good enough. How do you overcome the rebellion of man from within the rebellion? Well, that's not my problem. That's Dr. Pennington's problem. But let me just say that I think I may have passed up one possible solution too soon, this matter of telling a joke. You know, there's a tremendous power in humor. If you tell the right story, you can get people who hate you to laugh, and they'll be glad they did. My wife once insisted that I sit down there and watch a television show by Bob Hope. I didn't want to do it, but you know the book says go along with it now and then, so I agreed. But I sat there braced against it, and yet after 30 minutes my diaphragm was sore. I didn't mind. He did it to me, but somehow I was glad. I mean, it was with my concurrence. You know our notorious Bishop Oxenham. Well, he was conducting some conferences out on the East Coast a couple years ago. He went to one conference. A man came from the publishing house to give a check. And this man who came from the publishing house told three jokes. The next conference Oxenham conducted, the same man came from the publishing house and he told the same three jokes. At the third conference, Oxenham got there, Bishop Oxenham. And he said, now, men, there will be a gentleman from the publishing house who will come and tell three jokes. And Bishop Oxenham told the jokes. And then he said, now, when this man comes and tells the jokes, I don't want you to laugh. And in the Methodist Church, you do what the bishop says. The man came. The man came, he told his first joke. Nobody laughed. I mean, just 200, nobody's laughing. What if there were 6,000? Nobody's laughing. That would be a nothing. He went on, he told his second joke. Nobody laughed. Here's where he made his mistake. He went on and told the third joke. He should have known he was on the wrong track. He should have known he didn't have the right story. Because if he had had the right story, notwithstanding the demonic resistance that had been produced against him, he could have resolved these people into good-humored fellowship with himself. Notwithstanding their resistance and yet somehow with their concurrence. I say to you, Dante, the medieval poet, saw this clearly when he labeled the Christian story a divine comedy, which has the capacity to reach down into the deepest inferno of our rebelliousness against God and draw us up into the highest reaches of paradise with our concurrence. This is the power of the Christian church with the right story in its mouth. It has the power to overcome the rebellion of man and join man in reconciliation with God. But it must be the right story we tell. Or, as Mark Twain has said, the difference between the right story and the almost right story is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug.